Hello, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, The Global Agora. My name is Andrej Matyshak, and I work as the Deputy Head of Foreign Desk in Slovak Daily Pravda, which, by the way, means truth, and it's not Russian Pravda. Oleksandr Matvichuk is a Ukrainian human rights lawyer and head of the Center for Civil Liberties. Her organization was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2022. But unfortunately, we talk about the war, about the Russian full-scale invasion that has already been ongoing for 2 years. This is wishful thinking that Putin will stop. Putin openly talked about his goal in numerous interviews. He said there is no Ukrainian nation and that we are the same people as Russians, which means through his genocidal policy, Ukraine has to be occupied and the people in Ukraine have to be re-educated as Russians or killed, and that is why we have no other choice. If we stop fighting, there will be no worse, said Oleksandr to me. Listen to our conversation. If you enjoy what I do, please support me on Ko-fi. For the link, see also a description of this episode. And now, up to the new debate.
Now, let me start with something which is connected to my country, unfortunately, I have to say. Because we have a relatively new government, and Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico recently, just before he met Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal in Uzhgorod, he recently said there is no war in Kiev. His people then tried to explain he meant no front lines in Kiev. How do you react to such statements?
It's better to describe what does it mean to live in Kiev, where I am now. This morning, the huge explosions were heard in the city. And this is regular Russian air attack from which people in Kiev and other Ukrainian cities are suffering. Just recently, one of the last attacks in Kharkiv region resulted in death of the whole family, which were burned alive. Father, mother, and three children. They tried to hide in a bathroom. So probably it's not close to the battle zone, but the reality that you're not safe and you can't secure from the deaths in different parts of region in Ukraine, because there is no place anymore where you can hide from Russian rockets.
Of course, we are talking about a full-scale invasion. And we can also say that, and I think that you are all the time emphasizing this in your interviews, that in fact the war started in 2014. But if I may ask, it will be almost 2 years from the beginning of the full-scale invasion. How do you personally remember February 24th, 2022?
As a day when everything which I call normal life was crushed in 1 second. Because I still lack a proper word how to describe our experience, what does it mean to live during the large-scale war. To live during the large-scale war means to live in total uncertainty, because you can't plan your day, you can't plan your next hours, you have never know what will happen. To live during the large-scale war means that you live in total fear for your beloved ones, because a lot of our relatives, colleagues joined Ukraine armed forces, and even those who live in DP are not secure. And we lost the sense of normality. Everything which people take for granted, like possibility to go to work, to meet with your friends in cafe, to hug your beloved ones, to have family dinner, disappeared in one moment. And 24 February, like one very bright example which described this, I remember when we leave our flat with my husband and he stopped for 1 second with a key. He looked at me and he told me that we have lived so many happy years in this flat. And I kept silence, but on that moment, I don't know whether or not I will have an opportunity to meet my husband again, whether or not I will have opportunity to return home.
I think this uncertainty must be crushing, because as you said, you never know what can happen in a few moments or in a one moment. But maybe also, how did you perceive at the time the chances of Ukraine to withstand the Russian full-scale attack?
It's a very interesting question, because when large-scale invasion started, not just Putin, but also our international partners were confident that we can't resist, because Russia is an enormous opposing power. Russia was 11th economy in the world. Russia has much bigger population and strong military potential, the second nuclear arsenal in the world, and so on. And that is why even international humanitarian organizations evacuated their personnel. But ordinary people remained, and ordinary people decided to fight for our freedom and for our human dignity. And ordinary people started to do extraordinary things, and it were ordinary people who took people out from the ruined cities, who broke through the encirclement to provide humanitarian aid, who helped to survive under artillery fire, who took people out from the rubbish of residential buildings. And suddenly it became obvious that ordinary people who fighting for their freedom and human dignity are stronger than even the second army in the world. And I think this is very important lessons learned. For that moment, we have no idea about the future, because future is unclear and unguaranteed, but we have responsibility to fight for the future which we want for us and for our children. And Ukrainian lessons to the world is that ordinary people have much greater impact than they can even imagine. We get used to thinking categories of states and interstate organizations, but mass mobilization of millions of ordinary people can change the history.
Alexandra, apologies for asking about this, but have you lost somebody in this war? Loved ones or?
Yes, and not just me. I don't remember the concrete number in social survey, but up to 70% of Ukrainians told that they lost someone from their closest circle in this war. It means that the war knocked almost in each doors. One of the very difficult loss for me is my friend, Ukrainian writer Victoria Melina. When large-scale invasion started, she decided to document Russian war crimes and use this artist gathering and book fear just to tell truth what's going on in Ukraine. And she regularly visit East region in Ukraine. Also, she provide enormous work with children there. Then she was hit by Russian rockets in Kherson and Kramatorsk and died after several days while doctors struggled for her life.
I'm really sorry for your loss. But we can say that you are doing the same or similar work that she was doing. So can you tell me a little bit more, what is the main goal of your Center for Civil Liberties?
We have several strategic directions, because we and a lot of other Ukrainians define Ukrainian victory very ambitious. Ukrainian victory is not just to repel Russian troops out and to restore international order and release people who live in occupied Crimea, Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions, but also Ukrainian victory means to succeed in democratic transitions, which means that we have, even during the large-scale war, hardly trying to build sustainable democratic state institutions. And this is a war for values. Once again, this war started not in February 22, but in February 2014, when authoritarian regime collapsed in Ukraine and we obtained this chance for democratic transition. Returning to the first direction, we are documenting war crimes, and it's very difficult stories. With a huge amount, we face unprecedented numbers of war crimes. This is a conscious policy of Russian state. Russia uses war crimes as a message of warfare. Russia attempts to break people's resistance and occupy Ukraine by inflicting the nervous pain to civilians. So we document not just violations of Geneva and Hague Convention, we document human pain. And we are doing this not for historical purpose, because we are not historians. We are human rights lawyers, and we are doing this that sooner or later, all Russians who committed these crimes by their own hands, as well as Putin, Lukashenko, and top political leadership and high military command of Russian state, will be held accountable. And we know that we are doing this not just for Ukrainians, because all this hell, which now going on in Ukraine, it's a result of total impunity which Russia enjoyed for decades, committing horrible war crimes in Chechnya, in Moldova, in Georgia, in Mali, in Syria, in Libya, in other countries of the world. And we have to break this circle of impunity, because if we will not be able to stop Putin in Ukraine, he will go further.
You said that you defined victory very ambitiously. The Russians will have to leave your country, all the occupied regions. And of course, as you mentioned, the democratic transition and international justice are very important parts of what comes after the war. But the fact is, and I'm sure that you have heard this many times, even people who wholeheartedly support Ukraine are saying that it might be impossible to completely repair Russia. That at one moment there might be some territorial concessions. How do you react to this?
We hear this claim that we must give up some part of Ukrainian territories in order to satisfy Russian imperialist appetites for 10 years of this war. And we know, even from our near past, that this claim is not just immoral, because we can't leave our people alone for torture and death under Russian occupation. But this claim is wrong, because when Russia occupied Crimea and part of Luhansk and Donetsk regions, the Ukraine has a zero chance to return these territories. But Russia didn't stop. How Putin knew this time? Putin transferred Crimean Peninsula, a former resort, into a powerful military base. Russia trained and equipped their forces, prepared the economy for the possible sanctions, planned this attack, and started large-scale invasion. So this is a wishful thinking that Putin will stop. Putin openly said that about his goal to the numerous interviews in the recent, as he told that there is no Ukrainian nation, that we are the same people as Russians, which means through the genocidal policy that Ukraine has to be occupied, people in Ukraine have to be re-educated as Russians or killed. And that is why we have no other choice. Either stop fighting, there will be no more us.
I think that you're very right, unfortunately. And on one hand, I can understand some of those claims as somewhat rational. But on the other hand, I think we also should listen to Vladimir Putin. And he's clearly saying that he doesn't want Ukraine to exist. But if I may ask, on October 2022, your center was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Did this change anything for you or for what you are doing?
It's provided us additional opportunity to present our main messages. And our main messages are very simple, that human rights and peace are inextricably linked. That country which violates human rights provide a threat not just for their own citizens, but for the peace in the region and the world in general, and Russia is a bright example. Before, our voice of human rights defenders haven't been heard, and probably we was heard in some human rights premises like UN Human Rights Committee or OSCE Human Rights Dimension meetings, but not in the room where political decisions were taking place. And we always, with our human rights colleagues from different countries, trying to convince politicians that they have to make their political decision not just on economical benefit, their political perspectives, in their career intent, their illusion of safety or personal comfort. They oblige to take political decision, also taking into account values of democracy and freedom. Because if even you benefit in the short term and gain some economical result, you will evade for catastrophe in the long term if you disregard the values.
You are doing something which I think is probably also psychologically quite stressful, also to meeting people who suffer through a huge violation of their human rights or their relatives suffered. How do you personally cope with all of this?
It's not easy, and I have no easy answer, because large-scale war is very difficult from the personal and from the professional point of view. I mentioned that we document enormous human pain, and sometimes I have such pain that it's burning me out. I have never interviewed a child which were affected by the war, but my colleagues did, and even the story which we collected, it's very sensitive for me. Let me tell you one such story. This is a story of 10-year-old Ilya from Mariupol. When Mariupol was sieged by Russians, Russia didn't provide opportunity for International Committee of Red Cross to evacuate civilians. And that is why Ilya and his mother, they hid in basement, they melted snow to have water, and they made fires to prepare some food. But then when all the products ran out, they had to go to the flat, and suddenly they appeared at the center of Russian shelling, and his mother was injured in the head, and the boy's legs was injured. With the last strength, mother carried her son in the friend's apartment, and this was a moment where there is no medical assistant in Mariupol, because prior to this, Russians destroyed maternity hospital and the whole medical infrastructure. So they just lay in a couch for several hours and hugged each other. And then Ilya told to my colleague that his mother died and frozen in his arm, in the arms of a 10-year-old boy. I think it's a horror.
When I was asking you about how do you personally cope with this, how do you think this Ukrainian society is coping? Because a few months ago, I interviewed one Ukrainian director, name is Alisa Kovalenko, and we talked about this, and she was like basically saying me that many people at the time, at the beginning of the Buzhsky War, thought like this is going to be sprint. They focused totally on everything. Now they're burning out, at least partly, because it seems this is going to be a marathon. So how do you think that Ukrainian society is coping?
I think that we express enormous resilience. And there is one very human explanation for this. Because dramatic times provide people opportunities to express their best features, to become the best version of themselves. And now Ukrainian people for so long time in this very painful, bloody war, showing how to fight for freedom, how to be courageous, how to take difficult but right decisions, how to help each other. And what's helped us and me personally to continue this marathon is example of different people in different fields of society who help each other. And when you see this example, when people very generously do some extraordinary work for community or even risk their lives to save others whom they never met before, in this moment you understand that a lot of things that you find important in the life have no meaning, and only several things are very important. And in such moment when you help each other, you are acutely aware what does it mean to be a human.
Talking about help, Ukraine is receiving quite a lot of aid from the Western allies. But do you think that we are doing enough or not really?
We are grateful for this assistance because it's impossible to fight with Russians with bare hands. And we need weapons, we need sanctions against Russia, because these rockets which Russia used to shell Kiev this morning were produced because Russia still has money to produce it, or to buy Iranian drones from other authoritarian regime. When large-scale invasion started, the civilized world told, let's help Ukraine not to fail. And we obtained the first weapons to be able to defend ourselves, and first real sanctions against Russia were introduced into force. And we are, once again, we are grateful. But this is also an explanation why we was waiting for a first modern tent for more than a year. Why we had to start the counteroffensive without modern plane and still have zero modern plane for Western allies. Like, because there is a huge difference between let's help Ukraine not to fail and the goal, let's help Ukraine to win. And we can practically measure these differences in types of weapons, in speed of decisions, in gravity of sanctions. And we know that sooner or later it happens, but the problem is that times is passing very differently for people in EU, other countries abroad, and for people in Ukraine, because time for us converted in death, in numerous deaths in battlefield, in numerous deaths in deep rear, in numerous deaths in occupied territories. But important detail, because support of Ukraine is not a matter of charity. It's a pragmatist interest of democracy, because this is not just a war between two states, this is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And authoritarian regime can't coexist with a free world, because they see the human being very differently and you can't negotiate it. And that is why even existence of free world, it's always provided threats for authoritarian regimes, because people under the autocracy ruling also want to be free.
Maybe this is a little bit of a political question. We just witnessed changes in military leadership. They happened after last year's unsuccessful counteroffensive, which probably was also unsuccessful or not that successful because not enough modern military systems from the West. Was it the right move from President Zelensky to dismiss General Zaluzhny?
I'm not a military expert, so that's why I can't provide the proper answer. I can't estimate the effectiveness of Zaluzhny as a chief of army. But while I was afraid of this step, because Zaluzhny has a huge trust among society, and the trust is also very important resources in the war. But okay, it happened. Now we have a new chief of army, and as a Ukrainian citizen, I wish him success, because his success will be our success.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's very important having the trusted leadership and also the cohesion of the society, which is not that easy maybe to achieve during the large-scale war. And there is a lot of discussions about there might be a next wave of mobilizations. How do Ukrainians react to this, that it may happen?
Like, it's a sensitive question for each society. I just recently saw a recent survey which was conducted in countries of EU, and I was surprised with the numbers in some countries. A number of people in these countries told that if their country will be invaded, they will go to fight for the country and for their home. So it's not unique situation, because war is something unhuman and it wasn't our choice. But mobilization is a necessary step, because Russia is preparing for a long-lasting war. Russia mobilized people, and we expected that it can be some escalation when this imitation process of election will finish in Russia. So we have to be prepared.
Alexander, one last thing. And what you just said about preparedness, readiness of Western society to fight. In fact, in 2022, there was a survey conducted in Slovakia. And in fact, only 13% Slovaks said that they are ready to fight for their country. So this is it. But one last thing, if I may ask, and maybe we can look at the future a bit. What would you be doing if there was no war? What are you dreaming about?
When I was a child, I wanted to become a theater director, to organize performance in theater. And who knows, if I was born not in Ukraine, but in Switzerland, for example, I will fulfill this goal. But I was born in Ukraine, and very early I decided that I have to go to law faculty to study law, to fight for freedom and for justice. So I think that in my dream, in future, living in country where my work as a human rights lawyer has no urgency, probably I will return to my children's dream.
This was another episode of my podcast, The Global Agora. Subscribe, listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and on the other platforms. If you enjoy what I do, please support me on Ko-fi. For the link, see also the description of this episode. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.